Hello and welcome to a Weird News Roundup presented by Odyssey's Something Offbeat podcast. We bring you strange and interesting dispatches from Odyssey's newsrooms across the country. On this week's agenda, we've got a surprise great white shark sighting from WWL Radio in Louisiana, and an exploration of what's going on in our brains when we hesitate from KCBS Radio in San Francisco. Then we'll listen in on a discussion all about the Fire Horse Year and the Lunar New Year this week from the Dana and Parks Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City. Finally, this adventure will take us on a trip to the Old Farmer's Almanac headquarters with Own the Roads Kelly and Bob out of KRLD 1080 in Dallas. Our first stop will take us to the Chandelure Islands. These are a chain of barrier islands located in the Gulf, off the easternmost tip of Louisiana. They're home to numerous species of wildlife. Recently, that's included a great white shark, categorized as vulnerable by the IUCN Red List. Sean Powers is the director of the Stokes School of Marine and Environmental Sciences at the University of South Alabama. He joined WWL's Tommy Tucker this week to discuss this shark sighting.
Tell me how uncommon this is.
So a few years ago, we would have said this is really uncommon. In fact, the first one, my graduate students were out about 3 years ago and said that they saw a great white shark on one of our underwater video surveys. And I said, there is no way. Send me the picture. Send me the image. And sure enough, it was. And that's one of the first ones we saw. But now we're seeing more and more great whites. I think a lot of it has to do with this incredible tracking network that we're able to track sharks now, and that great white sharks are finally recovering after decades of overfishing.
Go ahead. I'm here every day, Doc. I want to hear you.
No, I just think it's really interesting that it looks like that the Gulf of Mexico, particularly the eastern Gulf of Mexico, from like the Chandeliers to Key West, seem like a really important overwintering area for great white sharks. And you know, that's something we've just recently learned.
How important are white sharks to the ecosystem?
So, you know, sharks fill this apex predator position in the ocean. So sharks are the largest predator of fish in the ocean, the largest predatory fish, period, in the ocean. And a healthy ocean has apex predators. So, you know, they both fascinate people, scare people. They're very charismatic. So people have strong feelings about them, but they're very important for the ocean.
Tell me about this particular shark.
So, you know, we've seen a few. There are a group of sharks that were tagged in Nova Scotia, and they named them all. The one I'm most familiar with was Ernst, which is the one we saw off Gulf Shores. It got within 4 miles of the coast off Gulf Shores, and you can go to osearch.com. And you could actually see where all these sharks are pinging. And, you know, so most of them that we've seen in the Gulf of Mexico so far are immature, which means there's still 12 feet, you know, close to 1,000 pounds. White sharks won't mature until they're in their 20s. So they're going to stay for a little further offshore than a lot of the small coastal sharks we're used to seeing. And they do that because they want those cooler waters. They come from Nova Scotia and they come down to the Gulf to feed. So they're chasing, you know, tuna, mackerel schools. And when it starts to warm up, probably April-ish, May, they'll hit the road and go back up to those colder waters. But they can come pretty close to the shoreline.
Do they travel alone? Because we got Ernst pinging, but is it likely that do sharks travel in schools or not?
Not these sharks. Great white sharks aren't really social animals. In fact, if you see a picture of one, you know, they bite each other. They're not very social. So they're going to go down more or less as single individuals, and then they'll group back up during reproduction. But they'll all follow the same track. But usually, you know, we've never seen a pair yet. We've seen an immature juvenile female and an immature male off Alabama on our surveys, but they were pretty far apart. So they're not known to form these big schools. Now, they'll congregate around areas if there's lots of tuna or if they're eating seals, obviously, in the colder climates on that one. They'll congregate around areas, but they're really not social animals. It's a tough life being a shark. Everybody, all your buddies want to kind of bite you and beat you up.
So they'd rather be by themselves, and then they attack each other sometimes to their own detriment?
No. They'll just bite like, you know, like any kind of wild animal that gets aggressive with each other and wants to say, hey, you know, get out of my space. There'll be little bites. I mean, they're not going to eat each other. No.
Okay. I didn't know about that. So how common or how likely is it that although not a social animal, that there are other great whites, maybe something mature or bigger than 1,000 pounds or 12 feet out there?
Sure, there is. In fact, if you the OSearch page, I got it right up on my computer. It looks like there's been four or five recent pings of different sharks. And they'll only ping when they're up on the surface because that's how GPS and satellite tags work. But they look like they're all kind of off West Florida now. In fact, even Ernst looked like he moved or she moved back to Florida. So we know that they go kind of all the way to the flower gardens off Texas, Louisiana, but they seem to be preferring the Eastern Gulf. But you can see them there. There's a, according to this, you know, there's four of them. So it's not just the one white shark.
For many of us, spotting a great white shark in the water during a nice day at the beach might make us freeze in our tracks. That type of hesitation actually happens a lot in everyday life. So what exactly is happening when we hesitate? New research might give us a better understanding. Steve Scott of KCBS Radio in the Bay Area recently spoke with Eric Itry, Associate Professor of Biological Sciences at Carnegie Mellon University, to learn more.
What does the research show? How do we decide when to act or when to hedge?
So the surprising thing is that it really comes down to a small group of neurons in a part of the brain called the basal ganglia. And we found that the activity of these neurons could predict how much our subjects would hesitate, when they hesitated. And interestingly, this is the same part of the brain that we know to be affected in diseases like OCD, ADHD, and addiction.
So, I mean, it's sort of, we sort of take for granted this whole idea of hesitation. What sorts of things influence it? I mean, is it just a matter of it's an unknown, it's a daunting situation, or are there other factors that that factor in here?
For us, what we saw is that it's really about the uncertainty of the situation. And it didn't matter in the realm that we were looking at if it was high stakes or negative situation. But I think there's an important distinction there between hesitation and indecision, which is vacillating between two options. And so it's sort of exciting to think about how the brain divvies up these two concepts that are very related, but not the same thing, and how the circuits decide how to proceed, neither wait even longer for indecision, or just have that brief gut check that we think of as hesitation.
For those of us who want to be more decisive in sort of day-to-day things, does this tell us anything about ways to train our brain to be able to do things more decisively and not hesitate so much?
I think forming habits, good or bad, I guess in this case, good, is really the key thing there. That uncertainty in your life can weigh on you. It can be a spark of excitement, but in terms of efficiency, the more habits that we can get into, even to the point of only having one set of outfits to choose from, things like that, that would certainly remove that hesitation and that bit of weight. It's really, again, all about the uncertainty in our lives that, that is leading to this this hesitation.
Habits are one way that we can take more control over future outcomes. Another thing that people turn to for help with their questions about the future is astrology. This week marked the start of the Fire Horse year in Chinese astrology. What does that mean? Stay tuned to find out more after the break. Thank you for listening to this special presentation of Weird News from Odyssey's Something Offbeat. The year of the Fire Horse galloped in this Tuesday. While the year of the horse trots in every 12 years, the year of the Fire Horse is rarer. According to the Old Farmer's Almanac, it happens in 60-year cycles based on the Chinese lunar calendar. Horse years are associated with energetic, confident, free-spirited, and naturally charismatic people being born. Fire is associated with passion and dynamic energy. Here's the Dana and Parks team out of KMBZ in Kansas City with some more astrology discussion.
Happy Lunar New Year!
The year of the Fire Horse? Okay. As memes about what is about to be unleashed go viral, Olivia Petter asked why so many of her friends suddenly believe that Chinese astrology is about to change everything for them. This is from The Independent. A friend was several minutes into telling me about her recent messy breakup when she paused for a moment of reflection. The headline, by the way, is Why Millennials Think the Year of the Fire Horse Will Save Them. Quote, okay. Anyway, it doesn't matter because it's all going to be fine soon, she said, smiling. Why is that, I asked. She responded, because it's the year of the horse. At first, I was confused. This friend had never before expressed any interest in the Chinese zodiac, let alone anything even remotely astrological or spiritual. But here she was, finding solace in the fact that from the February 17th, we shift from the year of the snake.
People follow that stuff.
Into the year of the horse.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know people who follow it?
I have read that there are people who follow it. Outside of just us announcing this is the year of the fill-in-the-blank.
Fire horse.
I don't follow any of it, no.
Michael Mackey was in, whatever, last week, the week before, and he was talking to me about it before the show. He was asking me, you know, what my sign was and when I was born and all that stuff.
What the astrology means. Yeah. And I do believe the calendar year.
Oh, here we go.
I do believe that there are those of us born in April who are so clearly the same personality type. And I don't know if that's because of the moon.
What is April?
We're Aries.
Okay.
I'm a Taurus in April.
And Taurus in April, it's me, a lot of my family members, you know an Aries when you hear them coming before you see them. And I do find that interesting. But are there wallflower Aries? I mean.
Do you know the symbol of the Aries?
Yeah, it's a ram.
That is correct. Aries is known for being bold, confident, and energetic leaders. They are courageous, independent, and passionate. Can be impatient.
Yes.
Impulsive.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
And stubborn.
But I also wonder, are there wallflower Aries out there?
Do you know the lucky color for the Aries?
Is it red?
It is.
Yeah, I thought so.
Interesting.
Now check out Taurus. It says something about strikingly good looking.
Yeah.
I don't believe that's accurate.
Smart.
Taurus, let's see, associated with stability.
Yes.
Ew.
Stubbornness.
Never.
And luxury.
Luxury.
Mm-hmm. Their traits are reliable, patient, practical, devoted, and responsible, but can be stubborn and possessive.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you agree, Sam?
Oh, yeah.
But aren't these, but hang on just a second. I'm going to go to Gemini because that's what I am. And I don't believe any of this garbage.
You don't
it's
believe in a
vague.
Well,
that's my point.
I don't think Aries is that vague.
You don't think so?
No.
Do you think you're not all of those things?
Yes, I am.
You're not a leader.
Oh, I will lead you right to a whooping for saying that.
You're not a leader any more than I'm a leader.
I think you're a leader.
I'm going to just leave that one between
of
y'all.
Of idiocy. Shonda.
Okay.
The mother of my two children.
Yes.
And she's a Taurus.
Okay.
And she really believes that stuff.
Okay.
I can remember, like, we would be, when we were married, we would be, like, at some event or whatever. And Taurus is, like, very stubborn, I think, and independent.
Yeah.
Whatever. And we would be at an event, and, you know, she would be telling the story, and she goes, well, you know why? It's because I'm a Taurus. And I would just like, oh, God.
Oh, for real? She, yeah.
She, like, yeah. believes that, or at least I got the impression she did. And I'm not talking bad about her. I mean, to each their own. I couldn't care less. But I just remember thinking to myself, no one can actually believe
that, yes, they
that,
do.
That the month that you're born in and the zodiac sign that you're born under is a predisposition to who you are going to become.
I do think that some of that stuff makes sense. Now, maybe it makes sense to me because, as Sam pointed out, it's vague.
Intentionally so.
But no, because Aries doesn't say you're wishy-washy.
When I was working the San Diego County Fair, around the booth from us was a, like, read your fortune, get your horoscope, put in some information, pay $15,
yeah.
and we'll give you 15 pages about the next 20 years of your life. Oh. And just for fun, I would ask some people from time to time, you mind if I read just the first page?
Right.
You know, we were bored, whatever.
Yeah.
And I'd read the first page, and a couple days go by, and I'd ask somebody else, and I'm like, this is literally the exact same first page that I read from somebody else.
All right, so here's Gemini.
4 days ago.
Here's Gemini, okay?
Okay.
Geminis represent versatility.
Okay.
Curiosity.
Yes.
Communication.
Love it.
All right. Geminis are known for being witty.
Okay.
Do you think I'm witty?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I, for one, am a proud Libra in Western astrology and a proud goat in Chinese astrology. Next year, 2027, is going to be the fire goat year, so I'm looking forward to that one. You can check out the Old Farmer's Almanac website to see how the year of the fire horse is expected to go for you. Speaking of that publication, Kelly and Bob Phillips of the KRLD show Own the Road with Kelly and Bob recently made a stop in New Hampshire, where they found
the little building on the side of the road that is the home to the Old Farmer's Almanac, an American institution that's been around since the late 1700s. It's run by a small but mighty band of almanac devotees, including its latest editor.
I'm Carol Kinnear. I'm editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, and this is my dream job.
Carol Kinnear thinks she may have been born to do this job, if it is a job at all.
It's hard for her to think of anything she doesn't like about it, including the state where it's located.
What I love about New Hampshire is the mountains and the lakes. I'm a big hiker. You can get out into the middle of nature so quickly in New Hampshire. I think that's a gift. I was born in New Hampshire, not too far from here in Bedford, New Hampshire. When I was a kid, I always had the Almanac and Yankee Magazine actually in our home. I went to school for journalism and communication, and I came and worked for Yankee Magazine when I was around 30. And so I was here for 5 or 6 years at that time on the other side. And then I spent 20 years at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And I did publications and fundraising, and I worked at the library. When this job came open, my daughter was a senior in high school, and so I could leave Massachusetts and come home. And so I applied for the job, and I got it 2.5 years ago, and it has been awesome.
This more than 230-year publication almost didn't make it.
Yeah, like the time an enemy spy was captured with a copy of the book.
That almost didn't happen because during the war in 1942, the FBI came calling. They had found a Russian spy on Long Island had been picked up, and he had an almanac in his pocket. And so the FBI was like, you can't help these forecasts.
Kidding.
No. And they thought the forecasts were just such sensitive information. They wanted the almanac to stop publishing, but R knew he had just bought the almanac in 39, Robert Sagendorf. He said, they're just weather indications. We're going to call them indications. And so he was able to keep publishing.
And even a future president is thought to have made use of the old farmer's almanac to prove his court case.
Another famous story is that Abe Lincoln used the almanac to free a man. He was charged with murder. And Lincoln brought in his almanac. The person who identified him said, I could see him clearly under the light of the moon. But that night was a new moon.
No moon.
So there was no moonlight to see the suspect.
Thank you so much for listening to this Weird News Roundup presented by the Something Offbeat podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to Tommy Tucker out of WWL in New Orleans, KCBS Radio in the Bay Area, The Dana and Parks Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City, and Own the Road with Kelly and Bob out of KRLD in Dallas. You can find these shows and the Something Offbeat podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.